In today's subject, voted for by the fine folk over on Patreon, we're going to look at some of the more notable times when merchant vessels ended up in combat with enemy ships, and how that ended up. There are, of course, some rather famous incidents, such as the last stands of the Jervis Bay and the Rawalpindi, but they'll be getting their own dedicated videos at some point. So for now, we're going to start off with an action that's actually so obscure that these days it doesn't even have a proper name. It's just called the Action of the 4th of August 1800. And there's also no paintings of it, so the ones that you'll be seeing in this segment are generic to the time and the ships in question. Apologies, but yeah, I can't retroactively go back in time and force people to make paintings of these things. Now, at this point in the Revolutionary-Napoleonic Wars, the French fleet was on something of a back foot. Various major engagements over the course of the past decade, such as the Battle of the Nile, the Glorious 1st of June, St. Vincent and Camperdown, had all sapped the strength of both the French fleet and its allies. A good portion of the Royal Navy was now sitting off French-controlled ports, which hampered further efforts at French fleet movements. But there was an Achilles heel to all of this. The British Empire funded its war campaign by means of its vast overseas trade network, which included lucrative convoys of East Indiamen, which, despite the name, also traded with China and various other parts of the world beyond the British-held portions of India itself. The Royal Navy did try to give a certain degree of protection to these merchant fleets, especially by use of escorted convoys, but even with hundreds of ships at its disposal, there was only so much they could do to cover the thousands or tens of thousands of merchant ships out at sea. Thus, it left the merchant trade somewhat vulnerable to pirates, privateers, or raiding enemy warships. Partially to help counter this, the merchants themselves were often armed to a certain extent, and would also sometimes paint themselves to more closely resemble warships to try and deter enemy attack in the first place. This could often allow them, or at least the largest of them, to see off pirates and privateers quite comfortably, but in straight-up combat, actual warships would make fairly short work of even the largest East Indiamen. The British blockade was moreover somewhat at the mercy of the weather. Especially on the French Atlantic ports, you would occasionally get large storms that blew in roughly east to west, and these would force the blockading forces out into deeper waters and thus open a small window where French vessels could escape. Since the weather was somewhat unpredictable and French ships of the line were scattered between various ports, and no storm was large enough to free up the entire coast at once, the main French fleet tended only to seek such chances if a very specific operation was planned for. But far more commonly, French frigates would make a dash for the open seas in these windows. Attempts to do so individually failed more often than not, as British ships from the blockade would often spot them and then run them down. So tactics had switched to sending out small squadrons of frigates. These would actually be harder to spot since there would only be one close formation in a small patch of sea rather than half a dozen scattered across a wide front. And if said squadron was spotted by a lone British frigate, that vessel would then have to go off and find help rather than engaging immediately. And by the time help showed up in the storm-tossed seas, the squadron should have been able to make good its escape. Such was the case in early March 1799, when the French frigates Concorde, Mide, and Franchise had escaped Rochefort. They then had a rather productive year raiding the trade that passed the west coast of Africa before heading over to Spanish-held South America for a refit. This refit occupied most of the first half of 1800. Subsequently refreshed, they headed back out to sea to look for more British trade to raid, this time on the western side of the South Atlantic. And soon they sighted numerous sails coming up over the horizon and duly moved to investigate. It turned out these belonged to a British convoy. The convoy consisted of 5 East Indiamen, 2 privately owned merchant ships including one former East Indiaman, and a whaler. Their sole escort was the 64-gun third-rate HMS Bellequoi under the command of Captain Rowley Bulteel. When they spotted the French formation, Bulteel realized that even though his ship was individually superior to any of the French frigates, they could use one or two of their ships to distract him or perhaps menace the closest merchant ship to him, which would force him to intervene, while the others seized ships at whatever end of the convoy he wasn't at. And moreover, two of the French frigates were large 40-gunners, with a third being a still substantial 32-gunner. Although none of them carried quite as heavy guns as his 24-pounder lower gun deck, between the three of them, they might well be able to cause significant damage to his relatively small ship of the line, and possibly even overwhelm him if they happened to get a lucky hit or two on his masts or rigging. And so he decided the only safe route out of this was to bluff. He immediately hoisted flags, ordering his ships to form a line of battle, something very non-merchant-like. Commodore Landulf, aboard the Concorde, saw these manoeuvres and closely examined his potential quarry through a telescope. What he saw was a formation of large ships that all seemed, at least, to have double rows of gun ports, all forming up and turning towards him. If indeed this was a formation of nine mixed third rates, perhaps on their way home from some distant foreign assignment, they would be fairly easily capable of smashing his force of three frigates. And so he ordered his ships to turn away, split up, and run. Captain Jurien, aboard the Franchise, however, thought that the somewhat slow nature of the convoy's shift to a line formation indicated that they were in fact merchantmen, and he protested the order, but Landulf, thoroughly deceived, overruled his subordinate. Bulteel, meanwhile, also realised he now really had to commit to the part. With the French turning away, if he, in turn, also turned back for home, it would very likely give the game away, as no force of ships of the line would simply content themselves with making an enemy frigate squadron run. And so he made a quick evaluation of which ships under his command were the largest and, relatively speaking, most heavily armed, as well as swiftest. Ordering the others to break off and resume their original course, he thus led Bellequoise, his only actual warship, after the Concorde, while the Indiamen Exeter and Bombay Castle were ordered to chase down the Midway, and the Coutts and Neptune were ordered after the Franchise. This would maintain the ruse, as after all, not all third rates were created equal, and nine ships against three frigates would also perhaps raise suspicion, because why would you need that much force? But this way, it looked like the slower sailing vessels that would have no real chance of catching the frigates were returning to their original course, while the faster vessels closed in on their targets, taking advantage of the heavier seas. And, obviously, two ships of the line versus one, in two cases, would still present a very overwhelming force. The fact that the combined crew complements of the pairs of Indiamen only amounted to about three-quarters of the complement of a single French frigate meant that you really had to hope it didn't come down to a boarding action. And also, although the pairs of Indiamen technically carried more cannon between them, carrying about 30 each for a total of 60, those guns were also generally considerably lighter than the French guns, Indiamen usually mounting 9 and 12-pounders, whereas the French frigates generally carried either a large number of 12-pounders or, in two cases out of three in these particular ships, large batteries of 18-pounders. The French bought completely into the ruse at this point. Seeing what they thought were fast ships of the line closing on them, Franchise began dumping a large portion of her armament and supplies overboard. This considerably lightened the vessel and allowed her to draw well enough ahead to vanish into the growing darkness of the evening. Bellequoise gradually began to overhaul the Concorde, and the two began a long-distance exchange of fire. Neither side hit anything, partly down to the range and partly down to the weather, but as the third rate was getting closer and closer by the minute, it wasn't too long before the frigate struck its colours, rather than risk the British warship hauling up alongside and then gutting the frigate with a close-range broadside that couldn't possibly miss. Meanwhile, the final French frigate, the Midway, had managed to outpace the Bombay Castle, but the Exeter, well-commanded and surprisingly swift for a merchantman, was closing in pretty quickly. Realising that whatever slim chance in an actual fight he might have had if operating together with the Bombay Castle was now long gone, Captain Henry Meriton of the Exeter decided to ratchet the bluff up yet another level. Neither side at this point had opened fire, Exeter to avoid revealing her true broadside, and Meaday to avoid provoking a potentially world-ending response from what she thought was an actual ship of the line. And so as night fell, Exeter opened every single gun port and other opening on its side, with the captain ordering lamps placed just inside each of them, giving them a rather ferocious glow. This light show, as well as making the ship look very intimidating, also further obscured the true nature of the Exeter, as it ruined the night vision of anyone who was actually looking at its side, and, of course, naturally gave the appearance of numerous lit gun ports all ready for action. Exeter then drew up level with Meaday, and Captain Meriton hailed the French ship, ordering her to surrender or be destroyed. Captain Coudin of the Meaday concluded that the British captain clearly wished to secure the most prize money for himself, since an undamaged frigate was worth far more than one that resembled a Swiss cheese. But he'd also clearly made the demand after having put his ship in a position where it could pulverise the frigate in very short order if it needed to. Thus concluding himself completely outmatched, Captain Coudin struck Meaday's colours and then took a boat over to surrender his sword. Of course, once he arrived on the Exeter, he realised quite quickly, and was also duly informed, that he had in fact just surrendered a large French frigate to a merchantman. But he was also just as quickly informed of the ancient law of no backseas, and was refused permission to return to his ship and actually try and fight it out. Naturally, the captains involved in the capture of the two French ships would make a fair amount of money from the proceeds of their prizes, and Captain Meriton of the Exeter would actually go on to fight French warships from the deck of an Indiaman twice more in his career, driving off an even larger and more powerful French squadron in 1804, before just about losing a fight between three Indiamen under his command and three French warships in 1810, although he would survive that engagement despite receiving wounds, and he'd eventually return to civilian life. Moving forward from the Age of Sail to the First World War, we find ourselves looking at the encounter between the Alcantara and the Greif. Now, just before the outbreak of World War I, two ships had been commissioned, one in Germany and one in the UK. Both had been almost immediately taken into naval service, and both would be at the bottom of the sea a couple of years after the war started. These were, as we just said, RMS Alcantara and SS Guben, not Goben, just G-U-B-E-N, which would then be renamed to Greif when she was commissioned into the Imperial German Navy as SMS Greif. But before their final confrontation, they were both refitted to entirely opposite purposes. Alcantara was a typical mid-size ocean liner of the time, capable of about 18 knots with a capacity of just over 1,000 passengers split between three classes. At 570 foot long, she was actually slightly longer than most dreadnought battleships, although somewhat narrower on the beam. She was a fraction shorter than the newest super dreadnoughts, but she still made for a relatively impressive sight. In early 1915, she'd been refitted into an armed merchant cruiser, armed mainly with six 6-inch guns, and thus she'd become HMS Alcantara, assigned to patrol the higher reaches of the North Sea as part of the British blockade of Germany. Due to her large superstructure, not all of her guns could be brought to bear on the broadside. Her notional broadside was three guns, although as her armament was arranged on the fore and aft deck with two guns per side forward and one gun per side aft, she could bring more guns to bear at certain angles that were more fore or aft, or at longer ranges, if the offside guns wanted to chance firing over the heads of their comrades, she might even be able to bring all guns to bear. The slightly smaller Greif was armed with four 5.9-inch guns and a single 4.1-inch gun, all in hidden compartments, plus a couple of torpedo tubes, and she, of course, was turned into an armed merchant raider. She was further disguised as a Norwegian merchant ship and dispatched in early 1916 to try and sneak through the British blockade, with an aim to raid British merchant shipping in the Atlantic on her way to the German-held portions of Africa, for which she'd been loaded up with supplies. However, she would end up being intercepted by the Alcantara, the British blockade having been forewarned by signals intelligence to be on the lookout for suspicious ships trying to break the blockade. The action would then unfold as described by Alcantara's captain in his action report, which I'll now quote from pretty much verbatim. On Tuesday the 29th of February at 9 a.m, I was in approximate position 61 degrees 45 minutes north, 0 degrees 58 minutes east, having ordered HMS Andes to rendezvous with me at 61 degrees 50 minutes north and 1 degree no minutes east to transfer secret papers. Just as an aside note, Andes was actually one of Alcantara's sister ships and was also an armed merchant cruiser at this point. Returning to the narrative, at 8:55 a.m. smoke was reported from the port beam, and almost the same time a signal was received from Andes stating enemy in sight, steering northeast 15 knots, and also another signal describing her, which I read as stating that she had two funnels. I at once increased to full speed and steered for the smoke. At 9:10 a.m. I sighted Andes, hull down, bearing north, true, and steering northeast, true. At 9:15, being about 6,000 yards off the stranger, I hoisted MN and fired two rounds of blank. The stranger at once stopped and made a signal, "I am stopped." She then hoisted her number, MG6, which was not in my copy of signal letters of ships of all countries. The ship's company was at action stations and the guns were kept trained on the stranger. About this time, 9:20 a.m, a signal was received from Andes, "Enemy has altered course to southeast," and I saw that Andes had also altered to southeast and apparently reduced speed. She was thus closing on us. When about 4,000 yards off the stranger, I altered course to port to keep this distance off while signalling her. It could then be seen that she was flying Norwegian colours, had Norwegian flags painted on her side, with the name Reina. I then signalled to Andes by searchlight, "Am intercepting suspicious vessel. Is enemy still in sight?" To this, no reply was made. In response to my signals, the stranger signalled that she was from Rio de Janeiro heading to Trondheim. These particulars, her size and course, all agreed with Lloyd's confidential list of ships. Getting no reply from Andes, I determined to put an armed guard on board the stranger, who appeared quite normal, and then proceed to help Andes with the enemy, as smoke had been sighted south-southeast. While getting the guard ready, I reduced to 14 knots and kept clear of the stranger's stern. At 9:35, Andes signalled, "That is the suspicious vessel." At 9:40, the boat was being swung out, and I was closing on the stranger on the port quarter when I noticed her ensign staff drop over the stern, and men clearing away a gun on the poop deck. At the same moment, the stranger fired a shell at our bridge, which put the telemotor steering gear, engine room telegraph, and all telephones on the bridge out of action, besides killing and wounding men. The flaps with painted-on flags on her sides were let down, and she subsequently fought under no flag. I at once gave the order for full speed and open fire. The range was about 2,000 yards. A messenger was sent aft to order the aft steering gear to be connected up, and all further steering was done from the aft control. The enemy at once went ahead and turned to starboard, firing high-explosive shell, some of them very short, but several hits were made near the waterline amidships, penetrating the number one stokehold boilers, which were half-empty, and the engine room. At 10:20, the enemy fired a torpedo which passed under our stern, starboard helm being used to avert it. The first round from our aft 6-inch gun, the port side one, hit the ammunition on the aft gun of the enemy and put it out of action. The German prisoners state that our third salvo all hit the enemy. At 10:15, the enemy was badly on fire by the bridge, and the range was 5,500 yards, and she had apparently stopped. At 10:22, boats were noticed leaving the enemy, who was enveloped in a cloud of smoke. I ordered cease firing, and the ship was beginning to list to starboard, but then suddenly listed to port. The smoke cleared from the enemy, and she fired one more round. I then ordered open fire, but at 10:35 the ship was listing badly to port and sinking. I therefore gave the order to cease fire, man boat stations and stop engines. The order to stop engines was never received, but apparently they stopped themselves when the water rose. Every effort was made to get the boats out and save the wounded, but several falls had been shot through and men were precipitated into the water. The ship was making about 3 knots through the water with the helm apparently harder starboard, but the ship turning to starboard. Bearing in mind at this point, British helm orders reflected the old tiller school of steering, so if you ordered the helm over harder starboard, the ship would actually turn to port, so this indicated that something had gone badly wrong with the ship's steering. Anyway, at 11:20, the ship sank. At least 15 boats and a large raft floated clear. HMS Comus and HMS Munster were rapidly coming up. Munster commenced saving life, while Comus proceeded to Andes, who all the time had apparently been about 8,000 yards off, and reopened fire on the enemy, which was still burning furiously. I am of the opinion that the enemy was completely abandoned by about 10:30, and that the round fired afterwards was due to an overheated gun. The statements of prisoners bear this out. A wireless message was received from Comus, but the decoded message never reached the bridge, and I was therefore unaware that help was on its way. I have the honour to report that the officers and men of His Majesty's ship fought with great gallantry and that no one left their stations until ordered to, and I personally witnessed cases of men assisting the wounded at great risk to themselves. A full report will be submitted later. The exact times will probably require revision when investigated, as those quoted are given from the memory of the navigating lieutenant who used a stopwatch, but whose notebook was lost while in the water. That's the end of the report. And now, Greif, which had a large cargo of cork on board, remained afloat for quite some time after she'd been abandoned, but the resumed fire of Comus caused a large explosion, probably her ammunition stockpiles, and she subsequently sank fairly rapidly. Now, sources differ quite considerably on the casualties, some suggesting that about 220 of the German crew were rescued while another 140 or so were lost, while other sources approximately reverse those numbers. Alcantara, meanwhile, lost somewhere between 69 and 72 men, and I wasn't able to find out exactly what her total complement was at the start of the combat, but it seems that the majority of sources indicate that most of the crew survived, which likely means the crew exceeded at least 200. And for our final battle, we go forward to the Second World War. In April 1941, the German Hilfskreuzer Thor had been at sea for nearly a year and was on her way back to Germany. During the course of her voyage, she'd run into and driven off two Royal Navy armed merchant cruisers, one of which was another iteration of the Alcantara, this time a 1920s version, and the armed merchant cruiser Carnarvon Castle. However, now she would run into the armed merchant cruiser HMS Voltaire off the northeast coast of Brazil. Voltaire was at this point almost 20 years old, having been built as an approximately 13,000-ton ocean liner capable of about 15 knots. She had the standard World War II British armed merchant cruiser armament of 8 old 6-inch guns and a pair of 3-inch anti-aircraft guns, with a total crew of about 270. Her guns were positioned fore and aft, with two per side at each end for a broadside of 4 guns. Thor was a smaller but somewhat swifter vessel, capable of about 17 to 18 knots and armed with half a dozen 5.9-inch guns, 4 torpedo tubes, and a scattering of anti-aircraft guns plus an Arado AR-196 floatplane. As a purpose-built raider, she also had a superior degree of fire control, although in both ships this was a somewhat limited affair compared to that available on a true warship. As she carried her main guns positioned one fore, one aft, and two on each side, she also happened to have a 4-gun broadside. Off the northeast coast of Brazil on the 4th of April, Thor spotted smoke on the horizon, somewhat closer to land than she was, and began steering towards it, hoping for an easy capture. Meanwhile, the Voltaire, seeing a smaller freighter appear, coming towards them, decided to turn to investigate. As the two ships closed nearly head-on, Thor fired a single warning shot to get the other ship to come to a halt. Instead, Voltaire replied with a pair of shots of her own. As the range closed rapidly, both ships now began to turn to bring their broadsides to bear, but Thor was somewhat quicker off the mark with a full salvo, scoring a series of critical hits which destroyed both the Voltaire's radio room and what passed for a fire control system. Left to their own devices, the gunners on the armed merchant cruiser had to load, aim and fire based entirely on their own estimations of range and bearing of the target. With a range well under 10,000 yards, Thor took advantage of its early hits and poured more shells in, setting Voltaire on fire. The steering gear then took a hit, and thus Voltaire began a grand circle, with only two guns left in action. Voltaire now managed to score a single lone hit to the top of Thor's mast, destroying some radio equipment, and at this stage of proceedings, sources conflict slightly as to what then transpired, but most of them seem to suggest that Thor's own 5.9-inch guns began to overheat as she'd expended an awful lot of ammunition very quickly, and thus the raider closed in to finish off Voltaire with torpedoes instead. But upon seeing the ship badly heeled over and men beginning to jump into the water, the German ship held fire, with a handful of isolated survivors on the poop deck waving a white flag. With the battle quite clearly over, and having detected no radio transmissions from the Voltaire, Thor then spent the next few hours rescuing survivors, saving about two-thirds of Voltaire's crew, most of whom would subsequently be transferred to a supply tanker just over a week later. Since indeed Voltaire's crew hadn't managed to get off a radio signal before the radio room was destroyed, the Royal Navy was initially completely ignorant of the ship's loss and would only learn about it from German propaganda broadcasts, although the propaganda broadcasts were careful to omit exactly which German ship had been responsible to help Thor in her secret mission to get back home. Subsequent investigation would confirm that wreckage from Voltaire was found, but the exact details of the conflict would have to wait till after the war when the survivors of Voltaire were repatriated. Thor, meanwhile, would manage to return safely to Germany, was refitted, and was sent out again on another long raiding voyage, which finally ended up with the ship docking in Japan. Although here she was destroyed when a ship adjacent to her in the port caught fire, the fire then subsequently spreading, engulfing the raider and a couple of other ships, which burnt all of them out.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.